You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, the wall, DACA, worker visas, all these points and more have come up over time in the immigration debate in this country. We'll look at the recent history of the immigration debate in the United States. First, it was less than a month ago that President Trump announced he would withdraw all 2,000 U.S. troops from Syria, declaring that ISIS has been defeated. The move was met with criticism from some Republican lawmakers and military experts who said a pullout could allow ISIS to regroup. It also partially prompted the resignation of Defense Secretary Jim Mattis. Since the president's announcement, the U.S. and its coalition partners have ramped up strikes against ISIS, destroying and damaging dozens of facilities and fighting positions. The U.S. has been fighting ISIS in Syria since 2014. The group has reportedly lost about 95% of the territory it claimed back then, but an August report from the Pentagon said there were about 15,000 ISIS fighters left in Syria. Last month, we talked with a New York Times journalist who was critical of Trump's decision to withdraw. Now we get a different perspective. Robert Spencer is the director of Jihad Watch and a fellow at the David Horowitz Freedom Center. He's the author of several books, including his latest, The History of Jihad from Muhammad to ISIS. He wrote a piece in the Front Page magazine on U.S. troops in Syria. Robert, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Well, your title of that piece was Trump is Right to Withdraw from Syria. So make the case, 2019, why withdraw the troops from Syria now?
Well, the arguments against withdrawing the troops from Syria are all based on the possibility, or likelihood even, that bad things will happen in the wake of our withdrawal. But this is a council of despair. Bad things are always going to happen, and they're going to happen whether we stay there or not, and when we withdraw, whenever we withdraw. And so what the people who are denouncing this are essentially saying is that we have to stay there forever, with no end point, no goal, no definition of what would constitute victory. And this is something I think that the United States simply cannot sustain.
The president had initially wanted all the troops out. He said now initially, then 30 days. That's been slowed down. Some reports saying 4 months or so. What do you think about the timetable for pulling the troops out of Syria?
Whenever he does pull them out, the people who have made up the Islamic State, ISIS, and other jihad groups are going to try to take advantage. We still have troops in Iraq, and if they do end up starting to regroup in any significant manner, then those troops will be able to handle that problem. So it really doesn't matter whether he does it now or in 4 months or in 6 months or in 3 years, the result is going to be the same. The idea that we can completely eradicate ISIS and destroy all the allegiance to it among the people who are allied to it with it in Syria or sympathetic to it in Syria is ridiculous, particularly in light of the fact that there's been no effort whatsoever to confront it on ideological grounds.
One of the big concerns raised by people who support Jim Mattis and his resignation, among others, is the United States' Kurdish allies in Syria, a fear about what's going to happen to them once the U.S. withdraws. Those Kurdish fighters are very worried about that themselves. What concerns do you have on that front?
Well, what I think is interesting about that is that the same people would say that we have to maintain our NATO alliances, and we're very upset with Trump when he said a couple of years ago that NATO was obsolete. And yet within NATO is Turkey, and it is Turkey that would be victimizing the Kurds. So they're going to have to decide, and the United States as a whole is going to have to decide whether Turkey is still a reliable ally. But here again, if Turkey were to move decisively against the Kurds, then we have troops in Iraq that can handle the situation. And the idea that we have to stay in any place that might be taken advantage of or exploited by our enemies when we leave is something that ultimately is going to end up destroying the United States military and possibly the United States itself, because it simply isn't sustainable on any consistent basis.
Talking to Robert Spencer about a piece he wrote in Front Page magazine titled Trump is Right to Withdraw from Syria, talking about the president's announcement that he would withdraw U.S. troops from Syria. We heard in response to that initial decision, Senator Lindsey Graham raising concerns that the winners here of a U.S. withdrawal would be Russia, Iran, ISIS, and the Assad regime in Syria. Now, he's been supportive of this slowdown in the troop withdrawal. What do you say to that concern that this is going to help Iran maybe in particular?
Well, the thing is that the Assad regime has been a client of Iran for years. It's not as if they're going to become a client of Iran now if we leave. We're not preventing their being a client from Iran even as we speak right now. They are at this point. And so the idea that if we're gone, this is somehow going to happen is based on a lack of awareness of the facts on the ground. The fact is that our troops aren't fighting Assad now or the Iranians. And Obama, during his administration, actually gave weapons and money to jihad groups, sometimes with direct links to al-Qaeda itself, in order to have them fight, here again, not against Assad, but against ISIS, which they ended up not doing because they were more allied with ISIS than they ever were going to be with us. The point here is that there's no real good guy in this. This is not a white hats and black hats situation. There are no forces there that we can point to and say, these people are pure, they have not committed atrocities, and we should therefore support them. The Iranians are already there. We can work against them in other ways. And the others that might take advantage as well can be dealt with more efficiently outside Syria than within it.
Some people might point toward some of the Kurdish fighters in Syria as maybe not pure white hats, I guess, but as reliable allies of the United States we wouldn't want to abandon.
Yeah, sure. And I'm not counseling abandoning them. But here again, I think we have troops in Iraq we can deal with, and a lot of the pressure on the Kurds can be taken care of if we make it very clear that Erdogan has to stop this adventurism or lose his NATO status.
Now, moving toward a bigger picture, in your piece, you say that it's not just Syria. We need to rethink, to reevaluate some basic assumptions of U.S. foreign policy and our deployment of the military. What kind of things are you looking for?
I'm talking about the whole framework of the interventions into Iraq and Afghanistan, and to a much lesser degree in Syria. In Syria, after all, we are just talking about 2,000 troops. It's not really a significant number. But in Iraq and Afghanistan, of course, there were the massive invasions and the occupations that went on for years, still going on in Afghanistan. Now, what's going to happen when ultimately we leave Afghanistan? The Taliban that we went in to topple is going to regain more control over more of the country, and it might well topple the Kabul government and take power there again, which would mean that we've completely wasted our time, our fighting forces, those who were killed, our materiel, our resources, billions, trillions of dollars. For what? For nothing. The whole thing was wrongheaded from the start. We went in thinking, and this was, of course, the Bush administration doctrine, that we'd be welcomed as liberators and we would be able to set up Western-style secular democracies that would become oceans of stability, islands of stability, anchors of stability, I should say, in the Middle East and in the larger region in terms of Afghanistan. Now, this didn't happen, and it was never going to happen because it was based on a lack of knowledge of the allegiance of the people to Islamic law and the idea that Islamic law should be the only legitimate basis for a government. So the whole thing, the adventurers were wrongheaded from the start. We thought we could buy allegiance by building schools and hospitals and roads and so on. None of it has worked out, and now there's no definition of victory, no understanding of what we're even there for, no objective, no goal. These things are just sapping our resources to no good purpose.
We're talking about President Trump's decision to pull U.S. troops out of Syria. Our guest, Robert Spencer, supports that move. He wrote about it in Front Page magazine. You can join us at 800-642-1234. Is it time for the U.S. to get out of Syria, or do you think U.S. troop presence is still needed there? What do you think is going to happen if and when U.S. troops are gone in Syria, or is it really not our concern? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll pick up that conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our conversation with Robert Spencer about President Trump's decision to pull U.S. troops out of Syria. He wrote a piece for Front Page magazine on the topic. You can join in at 800-642-1234. 1, 2, 3, 4. Do you support the president's decision? Or are you worried it could be a mistake? What should America's role be, if any, with regard to Syria, with troops in the Middle East in general? How worried are you about ISIS here or there? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll go to our callers now. Vern is with us in Boyd. Vern, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. On Afghanistan, it's kind of like the Russians being there. You can't win a war in a vast territory that's tribal in nature, and they have the help of Pakistan next door to them. You know, they knew Obama and bin Laden was there. We can't win any war in Syria or Afghanistan, and probably not Iraq either. It's cost us probably $10 trillion for nothing, and everybody's supplying them with weapons. And there's no end in sight. It's broken us economically, and we're spending 45% of our industrial production on tanks and stuff that, you know, they put heavy equipment there, they leave it there, and it's just costing us a fortune. It's breaking the United States economy.
Vern, thanks for the call. Robert, Vern, more or less on the same page with you.
Yeah, I think Vern couldn't be more right. The fact is that Osama bin Laden, let's remember, when he was explaining why he hit the towers and Washington on 9/11, he said that he wanted to destroy the United States economically. And I think in that sense, 9/11 was a remarkable success for al-Qaeda. Our resources have been squandered on these no-win situations that have not made us stronger but have only made us weaker. What we should have done was adopt a modified version of the old policy of containment that was used against the Soviet Union in the Cold War and concentrated on preventing jihad terrorists from entering the United States rather than go on these misadventures that were designed to build democratic nations in areas that were never going to accept that.
Thanks for that call, Vern. One of the arguments from the George W. Bush administration was along the lines of fighting them over there so we don't have to fight them here. The idea that an American troop presence in Afghanistan in particular, I guess, disrupted the activities of a group like al-Qaeda, maybe a group like ISIS now, so that they were less of a threat here in the United States. Was there anything to that?
Not really, no. There have been far more jihad plots and attacks in the United States than probably most people are aware of. They know about the Boston Marathon, maybe the Fort Hood massacre when there were 13 people at Fort Hood in Texas gunned down by actually a U.S. Army psychiatrist. There were four people killed in Chattanooga. There was the San Bernardino attack, many, many others. So it isn't as if we've really prevented them from coming over here or striking over here. At the same time, also, even when you've got ISIS, it's very good news. There's no doubt that ISIS has lost most of its territory in Iraq and Syria. However, they know that they've lost most of their territory, and they have shifted their focus, calling upon Muslims in the United States to mount lone wolf terror attacks against civilians. So this, in a certain sense, paradoxically, fighting them over there is making it harder to fight them over here and making them more of a threat over here. I'm not saying that we should not have done it. I'm all for having wiped out ISIS in the Middle East, but we shouldn't have any illusions that that means that everything is going to be okay.
Back to our callers now. Carol is with us in Milwaukee. Carol, hi.
Hello. I agree with the writer that we should get out of Syria, and I think we are wasting umpteen dollars on all our interest in the rest of the world while we are suffering here in Milwaukee with people who have to go to food banks and homeless people and all sorts of suffering that we don't have money for in Milwaukee, but meanwhile, they have umpteen billions and billions, and they want more billions. So I just think all of our exploits are leading us where Rome was led. They had a lot of territory that was way beyond the limits of Italy itself. They went all over the place, the Romans. It was very expensive, and in the end, they went down. We're going to go down even faster than they did.
Carol, thanks for the call. Carol sees U.S. Involvement around the world as an existential threat, it sounds like, Robert.
Well, there's a great case to be made for that. I mean, the drain on our economy is inarguable. And what really have we gained by being in Iraq, well, we're not in Iraq now, except with a small force, but in Afghanistan all these years, and in Iraq all those years before the pullout. Neither place became more stable or more of a reliable American ally. They're just as much of a morass as they were before, and there is still terror activity being plotted in both.
Thanks for the call, Carol, at 800-642-1234. Talking to Robert Spencer about his piece in Front Page Magazine, supporting President Trump's decision to pull U.S. troops out of Syria. Still time for your call at 800-642-1234. You can also tweet us at Central Time WPR. Kenneth joins us next in Janesville. Kenneth, hi.
Hello. Pulling out is going to go back to square one, where we were setting up an Islamic State that's going to, do what they did before. But we should use it to train our troops like the Germans did before World War II in Spain, to train our troops in actual combat, because this holy war is going to go on for the next 100 years, and we have to decide what we want to do, and we're going to have to learn to fight them really well.
Kenneth, thanks for the call. Robert, what do you say?
Well, I think that there's something to be said for that, but at the same time, I'm not sure that our troops are getting the kind of training that they need. The rules of engagement, particularly in Afghanistan, have hamstrung their ability to deal with the threat that the Taliban poses. And as far as them setting up Islamic States, Assad, there's no doubt Assad's a terrible guy and a vicious, brutal, autocratic ruler. At the same time, he's not like ISIS or al-Qaeda. He's not even a Muslim. He's an Alawite. And the Christian minority in Syria actually enjoys better rights and a better life in his domains than in the other areas of Syria that were controlled by other groups. So there's a case to be made for just letting it alone and, from a human rights standpoint, allowing this autocratic ruler to continue simply because he's better than the alternative. But we are going to be fighting this jihad war for at least 100 more years. As I show in the history of jihad, it's been going on for 1,400 years. Today's jihad groups consider themselves to be the children and heirs of those earlier fighters, and they are very patient. So this is really, ultimately, whether we stay in Syria or not, they're going to be still there, and they're going to be still active. We need to start to deal with the threat that they pose in a more knowledgeable and carefully strategized manner than we have been up to now.
Now we have President Trump making this decision. I think I saw a possible opponent of his in an election, Senator Elizabeth Warren, supporting that decision. Sometimes a troop withdrawal idea like this brings together people from the right and the left in opposition to, I guess, kind of a centrist establishment view of foreign policy. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. For the most part, for the last 17 years since 9/11, the Republican establishment and the Democrats have agreed that this interventionism is wise. But its results have been catastrophic. And so Trump and Elizabeth Warren paradoxically agreeing on this, they're both right. This is self-defeating, and it's making us weaker. It's not helping, so we need to abandon this whole strategy.
What do you see next? What kind of timeline? You said you're okay with just about any timeline that comes from the White House. What would be your advice on how best to withdraw from Syria?
Under the cover of darkness, without making any announcements, Obama withdrew from Iraq with great fanfare and set a date and so on, and that was just an invitation to the jihad groups to exploit that and to make hay right after we left. The best way to do this, whenever it's done, is such that nobody even notices we're gone right away.
And this is all happening in this backdrop of kind of a regional conflict between Saudi Arabia and Iran. The United States, a stronger ally of Saudi Arabia, obviously an opponent in the region of Iran. Do you think we should be playing a role in that balance of power there?
Yeah, absolutely, because Iran has designs upon much larger quarry. Of course, every Friday in the mosques, the people are actually ordered by the government to chant "Death to America, Death to Israel." And in my book, The Complete Infidel's Guide to Iran, a few years ago, I quote government officials saying, "These are not just slogans. This is our policy. These are our goals." And we have to understand that, and Trump is right to work to limit the power of Iran, but there are far more efficient and effective ways to do it than to keep a token force in Syria.
Let's take another caller. Jerry is with us in Stockbridge. Jerry, hi.
Hi. I'd like to comment. I mean, apparently your guest is aligned with Trump and his allies. Me, I'm in line with the American troops, the American officials that are in the know on military and the position, people like Mattis. And as a political foil, we don't have enough allies in the Middle East as it is. And this is a blatant betrayal if we pull out on the Kurds, who have been steadfast allies for quite a while. And basically, if we abandon this, all it is an open door for Putin.
Jerry, thanks for the call. Robert, in our last few moments, respond, please.
Yeah, the Mattis approach has been tried for 17 years. It has no successes. It has nothing to show for itself, and it needs to be abandoned sooner rather than later.
Thanks for the call, and Robert, thanks for joining us today.
Pleasure. Thank you.
That's Robert Spencer, director of Jihad Watch, fellow at the David Horowitz Freedom Center. He's the author of several books, including The History of Jihad from Muhammad to ISIS. We talked with him about a piece he wrote in Front Page magazine looking at President Trump's decision to pull U.S. troops out of Syria. Coming up, talk of a wall on the U.S.-Mexico border dominates the current conversation on immigration, but it hasn't always been at the forefront of the debate. Our guest political scientist joins us to talk about the history of policy and political rhetoric when it comes to immigration. And tonight at 8, President Donald Trump will address the nation about the border as the partial government shutdown continues into its third week. We'll bring you NPR News coverage of Trump's remarks from the Oval Office, followed by a joint response from Democratic leaders House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer. Listen tonight at 8 for live coverage and analysis on Wisconsin Public Radio or at WPR.org. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow after 7 on The Morning Show, Kate Archer-Kent and her guests look at the news from tonight's presidential address and the response from Democratic leaders in Congress. That's tomorrow at 7 on The Morning Show. Now, tonight's address by President Donald Trump will cover what he calls a humanitarian and national security crisis on the southern border. Comes on the 18th day of the government shutdown, which resulted from a dispute over funding for a wall between the administration and Democrats in Congress. A dispute between them, not a wall between them. Trump spoke to reporters about his concerns about the U.S. border with Mexico this week. Here's the president.
We have a crisis at the border of drugs, of human beings being trafficked all over the world. They're coming through. And we have an absolute crisis, and of criminals and gang members coming through. It is national security. It's a national emergency.
In recent days, the administration has suggested that the president might declare a national emergency for wall funding. How do we get to this point in the immigration debate, and have we seen anything like this before? Geronimo Cortina is an associate professor of political science at the University of Houston. His research interests include American and Latino politics and immigration. Geronimo, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much, Rob.
Well, let's take a step back from the news going on today and look at some of the recent history of immigration. Congress has been working, trying to come up with solutions on this issue for years. When was the last time we saw any substantial change in American immigration policy?
Well, that must be in the 1980s and the 1990s. So in 1986 was one of the biggest overhauls of immigration law. It was the Immigration Reform and Control Act of 1986. And basically, IRCA revamped the whole immigration system and put a lot of employee sanctions, so on and so forth. Then we move to the Immigration Act of 1990, and once again it changed the number of permanent visas and tinkled a little bit with the legal immigration system. Then we have another one in 1996 that basically once again changed some of the numbers, the procedures about asylum seekers, created the 287G program with local police, and then finally we have the 2000 was LIFE, the Legal Immigration Family Equity Act LIFE, that basically put family reunification as the bedrock of American immigration policy. And after that, we have obviously the DREAM Act in 2010, and that was it. And that was basically it, that it didn't pass, of course. But those are the four or five major pieces of legislation that have been up for discussion.
And even bigger picture, we've been having this debate about how many people can come into the United States and who can go into the United States, I guess, since the beginning of the country, right?
Well, I mean, immigration has been present since the 1800s. It has been a on and off topic, especially coincides very significantly with electoral cycles. But since the 1800s, we have had those discussions, right? We have seen what constitutes an American, who can be part of the polity, who can be a citizen, who can come, who cannot come. We have had, you know, the Chinese Exclusion Act, the Japanese Gentleman's Agreement with the United States. We had the Bracero program in the 1940s that ended up in 1964. So we have had a number of things since the country was founded by the founding fathers. So it's something that is not foreign to public opinion, but it has been on and off since the beginning of the country.
Now, in the last 10 years ago, I think there's a sense from everybody that something needs to change. They might not agree about what needs to change. Why has it become so difficult to pass things, especially in Congress, when it comes to border security and immigration laws?
Well, I think we need to understand the context. So I think, well, immigration policy as a policy issue, right, trying to think of immigration policy without the politics involved. I know it's counterintuitive and it's complicated, but immigration policy as a policy issue changed after 9/11. Why did it change? Well, remember when President Bush started to talk about immigration reform and having, you know, trying to legalize the status of millions of people, so on and so forth, came 9/11, and suddenly immigration policy went back to the back burner once again. So since then, there hasn't been significant movement of policy, and since then, immigration policy became part of, quote-unquote, of national security. It became more or what we call academics the securitization of migration. And that is a global trend. It's not only unique to the United States, but it also happened in many other parts of the world. So since then, it has changed to become a part of who can enter, settle down, and potentially be part of the polity to something about, quote-unquote, national security. And then after that, obviously, immigration, since it's so entrenched in American culture, right? We are a country of immigrants. So without immigration, we cannot think of the United States as the United States. And also immigration touches many, 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 many other policy issues, right? It touches the economy. It touches education. It touches health. So once you tweak a little bit on immigration, you're going to have intended or unintended consequences on other policy issues. So when we think about immigration, it's not only who can come, right, who can enter, who can have a visa, who can become a legal permanent resident, who can naturalize as a U.S. citizen, but we're thinking about taxes, we're thinking about education, we're thinking about healthcare, so on and so forth. So that's why it's a very, very, very complex issue. Now, if you inject politics into this policy issue, it becomes almost impossible to sit down at the table and have a real discussion about policy, not politics.
Geronimo Cortina is with us right now from the University of Houston. We're talking about immigration policy and border security in the United States. We have this news of the day now with the president talking about the government shutdown and border security funding. And we're talking about some of the history that led us here. Geronimo, let's talk about the president and what he's talking about today. He's using words like crisis at the border, talking about a national emergency, figuratively and maybe literally in terms of law. Given what's happening at our border now, do you see a crisis? Do you see an emergency as compared to any other time in American history?
No, well, I personally don't see it. I was at the border a couple of last year and did not see a huge emergency or anything like that. Of course, there are problems at the border, but there are problems like anywhere else. So the fact of the matter is that migrant border crosses have been declining for almost two decades at the southern border. The majority of people that overstayed or enter the country or stay in the country without proper inspection are people that were admitted with a visa, and basically they're overstayers. They overstay their visa, and suddenly they become undocumented. The fact of the matter is that migrants are less likely to commit crimes in the U.S. The fact of the matter is that the most or part of the most safest cities in the United States are at the border, if you compare it, you know, with other cities in the country. So there is not such a crisis at the border. And then if you go down to the border and ask people, right, if they want to see a border, most of the people are going to say a border wall. Most of the people don't want to see a border wall. And the other fact of the matter is that we already have some sort of wall or barrier or pedestrian barriers or vehicle barriers in almost a third of the continental border between Mexico and the U.S. So what is so the fact that we're talking about a crisis, the fact that we're talking about a chaos at the border is not being supported by the data and even by some of the reports done by the current administration. A couple of days ago, a couple of months ago, I don't remember very well, there was this report by the Secretary of State saying that there was no credible evidence that indicated that international terrorist groups have established bases in Mexico in order to cross from Mexico to the United States. So we have to see what the president is going to make a case. He can make a case, of course. Border security is very important. No one is arguing about that. But I think the means about which border security is going to be achieved, that's what's up to discussion.
We're exploring some of the history of the immigration debate in the United States up to what's happening tonight in the Oval Office. Geronimo Cortina is with us, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Houston. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think needs to happen to see immigration changes in this country? Are there compromises you'd like to see when it comes to border security funding and allowing people into the country legally, the status of people who are here without documentation? What do you think about this possibility of a declaration of a national emergency by the Trump administration? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our look at how we got to where we are in the immigration debate today. Geronimo Cortina stays with us. He researches American and Latino politics and immigration at the University of Houston. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to see happen when it comes to immigration laws and border security? Call 800-642-1234. Before we go to our callers, Geronimo, you mentioned how the issue of immigration has been treated more as a security issue in countries around the world. How about as a national identity issue? It seems like there are a lot of political movements and political parties from the United States to Hungary where the issue of immigration and the influx of immigrants is treated as a threat to the identity of that country. How do you see that going in the world now?
Well, I mean, indeed, we have had some nativist movements, especially in Europe, and frankly also in other parts of the world. But in those places, I think there is a very, very unique significance of what it means to be a national of country X versus a national of country Y. If you look at the debate, for example, in the United Kingdom, you see people openly addressing immigration like, we don't want you because you don't look like me, right? And those are what political parties over there are trying to basically proclaim. Here in the United States, we have a very different approach, right? The first one is that our foundational myth is based on, to one extent, on immigration. We're a country of migrants. We have the Statue of Liberty that says, give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses, you're into very free. So we have a different approach to immigration on the one hand. On the other hand, we have these knowledge that we are a country that has been built by the melting pot. So we can discuss what it means to be part of the melting pot. We can discuss what it means, instead of having a melting pot, to have a tossed salad. Or we can think, right, of another analogy in terms of assimilation or incorporation in terms of the tomato soup debate, right? And basically the three have very distinct approaches. The melting pot means that once you come to the United States, you're going to jump into that melting pot, just following the analogy, and suddenly once you get out of the melting pot, you are going to be an American, whatever that means, right? And we don't have a clear definition of what it means to be an American. It would be an American to define American is X, Y, or Z. The tossed salad analogy is that you come into the country as a tomato, right? And you're going to mingle with the lettuces and you're going to mingle with the onions, so on and so forth. But you keep your individual identity, but everyone forms part of a salad, of a unity, keeping individual's identity. And then you have the tomato soup. And the tomato soup is whatever you put into the tomato soup is not going to change its flavor. So that means that it's not going to accept anyone that is not part of that tomato soup. So we have these distinct parts of assimilation, these distinct parts of incorporation into American culture. But the issue here is that we don't have a clear definition of what it means to be part of this great culture. And that is part of the debate, right? That is part of the debate in which different people may have different opinions about what it means to be an American, but that's the beauty of the country. That's the beauty of being part of America.
I want to bring in a couple of callers now. John is with us in the Eau Claire area. John, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to tell us about, John?
Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to mention, I was in Honduras a couple months ago, and a lot of the people that I met a lot of people that had come to the United States or had family members that are in here now or had been in the past, and almost all of them come back. They're not planning to stay, but they're there because of the labor. And I think that the biggest issue we're not dealing with is the undocumented workers and how much our, especially agricultural and some food service industries, are relying on that labor at that rate. And it's a ton of money in Honduras when they send money back, even if they're not making a lot here. But I think that if the issue of the labor that's needed in those industries is dealt with, I think that's the heart of the issue, and we're not dealing with it, I think, because a lot of people need that labor.
John, thanks for the call. Geronimo?
Well, absolutely. I couldn't agree more. And that's part that immigration has been so entrenched into our American economy. When you look at different rates of migrant employment in very particular industries such as agricultural industry, services, and construction, you see an overrepresentation of migrant workers. And the issue here is that our H-1B visa program, the one that has guest workers, it simply doesn't work. It's not expedited enough. It's not easy enough for owners of land or ranches or farmers to bring people back to the industry. And you see it over there in Wisconsin with the dairy industry, right, that is so reliant on migrant labor. So if you need to milk a cow, right, you need to milk it. It's not that you can wait 3 days or 5 days or 1 month. You need labor. And that labor is going to come whether we like it or not. And it's just simply the loss of supply and demand. So in order to work on those things, right, we need to have a guest worker program that allows circularity, that allows people to come when the seasonal work is up, and then go back to the countries of origin when they're not working, and provide some safeguards so the people that invest in bringing those guest workers don't have to reapply again and then again and again and then again. So it's some of the things that we can work out very, very easily with the countries of the region.
John, thanks for the call. Go next to Scott in Milwaukee. Scott, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I think... the question that you asked your guest about crisis is really a security question to ask somebody. I mean, crisis is basically two things to different people. Somebody in Wisconsin doesn't see a crisis, but the guy who's sitting on the border and basically has a rush of people coming at him, his life is in danger. That's definitely a crisis. And they said the other day that basically 800,000 people they catch coming in illegally, and they guess that it's probably about one or two, conservatively. That means 800,000 people are getting into our country illegally that we can't do anything about. And the politics of it is that you already have, way back years ago, both sides said we're going to fund a wall, and yet we still haven't appropriated the money. So it's really a political thing that has stopped the wall from being built. Everyone realizes that a wall is going to help. We should, for one thing, for a crisis, we should have somebody, not to say anything against your guest, the poli-sci professor, is somebody who's in security. And say, yeah, well, these things, walls do work when you're trying to put an impediment against people wanting to come here and also people that rush the border.
Scott, thanks for the call. So, Geronimo, I mean, would an actual wall, concrete, steel, whatever, help act as a deterrent to people trying to cross the border illegally?
Well, I mean, as I said before, we have already around 600 miles of border fences, walls, et cetera, already being built. They're there over there. And, you know, the first piece of the wall was in the 1800s when the U.S. Purchased the Gadsden purchase of, I think, 1853 or something like that. I think it's important to recognize that at the border, that on average, in those border counties, you don't see much more significant violence or crime, et cetera, that you would expect to see in other cities around the country. So I understand that every single country, and this is extremely important to understand, every single country has the sovereign right to protect its borders, right? It's the notion of the state. Without borders, we would not have states. And the notion of the state, and the responsibility of the state, is to protect its borders. Having said that, we have to also understand that walls do not necessarily help us, especially at the southern border. Why? Because of the geography and the whole kind of the terrain that makes it impossible to build a wall in big sections of the border. I mean, if you go down to the Big Bend here in the Rio Grande Valley, it's impossible to build a wall over there. Why? Because you have mountains, you have water, you are entering in a legal conundrum that would not allow the U.S. government to build a wall. You can have security measures, and that's what a lot of Republicans and Democrats are arguing, to have smart technology, right, allowing to monitor the border in a much more efficient way, rather than building a wall that later, right, has to be maintained, that later has to be controlled, that later has to be repaired. And that's money that we're going to pay eventually in the future. It's not a one-time purchase and that's it. But we would have to maintain the border. We would have to, you know, fix a hole or replace a fence or this or that. And then you have the environmental consequences of building a wall. And the environmental consequences are that species cannot cross the border back and forth following their migration patterns. And that could have very important implications for the environment down there.
We'll have to leave it there. Thanks to Geronimo Cortina, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Houston. His research interests include American and Latino politics and immigration. We've been talking about the immigration issue now and in the past. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, we'll look at tonight's address by the president, the response from congressional Democratic leaders, and what it all means for the shutdown and the immigration debate. Plus, we'll ask you, what do you miss most from the era before the internet? That and more coming up tomorrow on Central Time. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's The Morning Show. Tomorrow at 6, Kate Archer-Kent and her guests take a tour of the Mississippi River to find threats to water quality and ways to protect the river and its watershed. That's tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then a time management expert tells us how to make the most of our time off of work and, you know, still leave some time to chill. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.